I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are journalists and authors Maddie Friedman and Philip Gurevich. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Maddie Friedman and Philip Gurevich. Maddie Friedman's first book, The Aleppo Codex, won the prestigious Sammy Rohr Prize in 2014, the American Library Association's Sophie Brody Medal, the Canadian Jewish Book Award, and other honors. It was published in Israel, Australia, Holland, France, Germany, the Czech Republic, Russia, and South Korea. Maddie's reporting has taken him from Israel to Lebanon, Morocco, Moscow, the Caucasus, and his writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and elsewhere. He's a former associate press correspondent and a regular contributor to Tablet magazine. Two essays he wrote about media coverage of Israel after the 2014 Gaza War for Tablet and The Atlantic triggered intense discussion and have been shared together on Facebook more than 100,000 times. Maddie's latest book is Pumpkin Flowers, a Soldier's Story, for which the New York Times said was on par with Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried. Appearing in conversation with Maddie is Philip Gurevich, a regular contributor to The New Yorker since 1995 and a staff writer since 1997. He's traveled extensively for the magazine, reporting from Africa, Asia, Europe, and across the United States. He's written about the aftermath of genocide in Rwanda and Cambodia, about the dictatorships of Mobutu Sese Seko in the Congo, and Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, Jean-Marie Le Pen's National Front in France, and about the American soldiers who served in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Philip is currently the Stein visiting writer at Stanford University's Creative Writing Program. Let's give them both a very warm welcome.
This is Maddie Friedman, and it's a really great honor to be here with him and to be talking chiefly or on the occasion of his new book, Pumpkin Flowers, which is a deep book and a wise book, and it's a really very beautifully written book, too. And it's a memoir, but it's much, much more than your own story. But maybe just to start with, it's the only book. If you read only one book about the 15-year Israeli war in the security zone of southern Lebanon, it will be this book, and it should be. Maybe you can just tell us a bit about how you came to be there and why.
Sure. First of all, thank you so much. It's really an honor for me to be here with you. I'm one of my journalistic heroes, and thank you so much for coming. I was born in Toronto and lived there until I was 17. And left for a year after high school in 1995 to work on a kibbutz. It was supposed to be a year, and that was 21 years ago. So things kind of got out of hand, and I'm still in Israel. Once I decided to stay in Israel and become a citizen, I knew that that would trigger a draft notice, which happened in the summer of 1997, and I was enlisted and sent to an infantry unit. At the time, the good infantry units were engaged in South Lebanon. There was a strip of land along the border, along the northern border inside Lebanon that Israel controlled in order to provide a kind of buffer zone to protect the border from attacks at that time, chiefly from Hezbollah, which is a Shiite militia. And I found myself having blundered into this strange little war from a quiet neighborhood in Toronto. At an isolated outpost about 5 miles north of the Israeli border called the Pumpkin.
So why was this place called the Pumpkin?
That's a great question.
I mean, it seems like a kind of odd name for a forward operating base in a modern war.
Yes, so the American military likes to call things aggressive names. So, it'll be forward operating base Apache or something like that, something scary. And the American military calls its weapons scary names like predator or hellfire, things like that. And if you listen to call signs on the U.S. military radio, it'll be the call signs are cougar and bayonet and things like that. It's completely different in the Israeli military. The Israeli military speaks a language that's largely floral in nature. In Lebanon, I'm serious, in Lebanon, all these grim bases were about as grim as they get, right? These are kind of emplacements surrounded by machine guns and barbed wire and dangerous and grim places. They all had names of plants. So our outpost was called the Pumpkin, and nearby was Outpost Red Pepper and Outpost Citrus and Outpost Cypress and Outpost Basil. Those were the names of the outposts. On the military radio, if you have casualties, if you want to report wounded soldiers, you don't say, "We have wounded soldiers." Military language is designed to provide you some distance from the stuff you have to describe in the army. So in the U.S. military, you know, for a fatality, you'd say KIA, because the American military likes bureaucratic acronyms. So KIA sounds like a tax form or something. The Israeli military has botanical euphemisms. So a wounded soldier is a flower. You'd say, "We have a flower." And a dead soldier is an oleander. So if you had a wounded soldier and a dead soldier, and you needed a helicopter, you'd say, "We have a flower and an oleander, and we need a thistle." The whole language was very botanical and very, very strange. It's one way of dealing with it, coding.
And is that really stuff, like, to cosmeticize, like to soften the blow for not, obviously not for eavesdroppers, but for the people who are saying it, that like you're looking at your dead buddy and somehow it's a little easier to say
oleander. So every military provides soldiers with this kind of jargon. And I didn't think about it at the time. I was 18, 19, and my mind was unformed at the time. But every military needs to provide soldiers not just with weapons, but with verbal weapons to allow them to function. So in the British military, for example, if you have a wounded soldier, I hope I'm getting this right, it's T1. So instead of saying the name of the soldier, you wouldn't say Tom has lost his legs. You'd give the first two letters of his last name and the first four numbers of his serial number. So you'd say Alpha Charlie 4586 is T1. So you've removed yourself completely from the real world of your friend having had something absolutely terrible happen to him, and you're in a different world with a different language. And it's the same thing in the Israeli military, except with this strange horticultural jargon that instead of coding things with aggressive terminology or with bureaucratic terminology, coats them with kind of agricultural terminology, which is very Israeli. I don't know exactly what the roots of it are. I interviewed a linguist about it, and he didn't know, but it's a pretty safe bet that it has something to do with the agricultural preoccupations of the early state or pre-state militias like the Palmach, which of course were heavily made up of kibbutzniks and people who had farming on the brain.
And did it work? I mean, did it for you, this young soldier, achieve this function of making, I mean, this young soldier who would become a writer and would think a lot about language and would end up drawing attention to this language by calling the book Pumpkin Flower, did it work? Did it actually have that effect? Or did it make it more absurdist and strange?
It made it more absurdist and strange. It made the whole thing, you know, weirder. To be at a place called the Pumpkin and the flowers and we had weapon systems called, and this would never fly in the U.S. military. We had the tank gunners had a night vision sight that was called Artichoke. We had this system that warned us of incoming mortar shells, and it was called Buttercup, Nourit Buttercup. This would never happen in the U.S. military, and it didn't. And at the time, I had never been in any army, and I'd never been anywhere basically except Toronto and this weird outpost. So it didn't strike me. But in the years that have elapsed, and having read some of the writing that's come out of the American military experience for the past decade and a half, the language jumped out at me as quite strange and uniquely Israeli.
Were you already thinking of yourself? Were you writing while you were there?
I had done an internship before my draft at a magazine called the Jerusalem Report, which at the time was a great English language biweekly news magazine. So I'd done some writing. I didn't really see that as a career. When I was in the army, most of the time I was too exhausted and depressed and preoccupied to actually do any serious writing. So no, I don't think I thought I would one day write a book about this hilltop.
And you say that when you made Aliyah, you knew that by becoming an Israeli citizen, you were essentially enlisting sooner or later, within probably a matter of, at your age, a few months or a year.
So you'd made that decision. Were you idealistic about it? Did you think of yourself as sort of fighting for Israel, fighting for the Jews, or that you wanted to be an Israeli and this was simply a rite of passage? You say you were depressed, that most of you write very... I mean, one of the important things to understand about this book is that unlike most of what we read about Israel and unfortunately about war anywhere today, it's just an honest war memoir. It's not trying to dress things up one way or the other or make it... It's not polemical. It's not ideological. It's in some ways about a generation, which we can talk about also, that was feeling pretty unideological even in the midst of war. But it's also very much about, you know, what is it like to be a soldier? You're tired, you're hungry, you're cold in Lebanon at night.
You're bored.
Occasionally, you're scared silly. A lot of the rest of the time, you can't quite figure out why you're there. You're not thinking too hard about the political situation or the larger geostrategic context in which you're existing. You're thinking about your buddies. You're thinking about the women that aren't there and maybe never were. And you're sort of, and in this case, you're very, very isolated. You're not in movement. You're not in war. You're at an outpost of progress, as Conrad called one, and it didn't go well there either. So you know, what were you thinking when you went in? Were you thinking, or did you sort of think, I want to be an Israeli. This is what I got to do. I want to be made an Israeli by this.
It's kind of hard to reconstruct how little you once. You once knew, and in my when I think back, I knew all of this, and I was well aware of the complexities, and I knew where all this was going. But if I'm honest about it, I think that it was the latter. I'm not a warlike person. I have no, my father never served in any military, and he was a Vietnam era. He is a Vietnam era American with all of those associations. But I knew that if I wanted to be an Israeli, I had to do this.
Is that how he ended up in Canada?
He had a deferment before he went to Canada. This is very important in our family.
No, I ask because it's important in any family that ended up in Canada at that time with that age.
He did end up in Canada at that time, but it was after he had the deferment.
So you don't have to thank Jimmy Carter for being allowed to come here?
I knew that if I wanted to be an Israeli and not just be a foreigner living in Israel, and there are many people like that, I had to have this experience along with the Israeli guys my age. So I ended up on a kibbutz, having gone to Israel at 17. I ended up on a kibbutz, a very small, also isolated hilltop. Weirdly, I seem to have an affinity for places like that, a little religious kibbutz called Ma'ale Gilboa, which is about 2 hours north of Jerusalem. And the kids on the kibbutz basically adopted me, and they were all going into the army. So I went in with them, and I knew that I would come out the other end like them, and that's more or less what happened. Bizarrely, my experience of becoming Israeli happened in Lebanon.
Were you religious when you went in?
I come from a traditional family, so yeah, more or less.
Did you become less so in the military, or?
I
don't know how religious you are now, but
exactly.
I've always been
religious. Basically, to the same extent, I find a lot of meaning in Jewish tradition. I think I thought then, and I think now, that Shabbat is the greatest invention of all time. Certainly now, in the world of electronic devices, I don't have a deep, religious soul or anything like that.
And so you end up at this place without. What were you told you were going there to do? Like, I mean, usually when soldiers are sent, especially to a front line or an outpost or across, I mean, you weren't in Israel, you were across the border in a sort of nebulous no man's zone that actually was a foreign country.
That's right.
Certainly Israeli military lore and history and the stories that we know in the rest of the world is this highly motivated army, this army that's sort of, if not, either very idealistic or very indoctrinated, depending how you look at it, but at least has a very clear idea of what it's doing and why it's there. And if it's not absolutely convincing, they're out of there. What was going on? What did they tell you?
I'm not sure I want Israel's enemies to hear this. because, of course, we're all incredibly motivated and indoctrinated and ruthless and willing to sacrifice, and the mission is entirely clear to us.
But you left that part out of the book.
So please don't invade us, is what I'm trying to say. The Israeli military, because it's a draft, is full of all kinds of people. It's not at all like the U.S. military. A lot of the guys there, weirdly, in the best units, it's a very kind of contradictory situation. In the best units, you'll find mainly middle-class kids who have very mixed feelings about about it all. So motivation is, it's a problem. You basically have guys who understand that it's necessary, what they're doing is necessary. They're proud of what they're doing. But in my time, at least, they were very unideological or anti-ideological. They were very cynical about the military. They were not, you know, they would find it very difficult to talk about Zionism, or no one ever talked about that at the outpost. And I write this, there was no ideology at the outpost. And Herzl and Ben-Gurion, those were just streets to the kids at the outpost. There were schools. It's a completely different generation. And I think when people in the West are reading about Israel, they're still kind of stuck in an Israel that, you know, a generation or two ago, when Golda Meir meant a lot and Moshe Dayan meant a lot and the Six-Day War meant a lot, it doesn't anymore. It doesn't, and the country's in a completely different place. I think it might well be in a better place, but it's certainly a different country made up of a very different kind of people who I think are not understood well enough outside of the country.
There's a saying, I'm going to paraphrase it wrong, but you describe the guys in the company before you, but your company, but the rotation or two before you, where the expression would be, you know, sort of, if the going gets tough and you just sit there, you know, with a question mark at the end. And they made their slogan, so when the going gets tough, you just sit there, period.
Right.
That was sort of the way you capture that mood. Where did that come from? In other words, well, I'm a bit older than you, and so the people I went to high school with, if they were in Israel, would have gone into the first Lebanon War in the early 80s. They were being brought up on sort of post-Six-Day War, post-48. They were the first generation born there, and they had a very different idea than either refugees or pioneers. They were Israeli because they were born there. But you're talking about people who are Israeli because they were born there to people who were born there.
That's right.
And that is really very far removed from any... I mean, that's more like us in America after generations. You're not here because you had some big idea about settling America. You're here because it happens to be that way.
Right.
And you may very well believe in it and want to defend its existence. I mean, that's a point you make. They're not ideological, but they didn't have to be there. What does that mean? They all could have chosen a different tour, a different service?
If you really didn't want to be a combat soldier, you could get out of it. And the units that were deployed inside Lebanon at these isolated outposts were basically volunteer units that were a bit more specialized than the average infantry unit. So if you were at one of these outposts, it meant that you had chosen that kind of service. I think for most of my friends, they were protecting their home. There wasn't anything very complicated about it, and it wasn't an idea. I don't think anyone in my platoon, maybe with a few exceptions, you know, had ever read any of the Zionist thinkers, except, you know, for what they made them read in high school, like American kids have to read, you know, the Constitution or something like that. It was their home. This was expected of them. If you were a man, this is what you did, and you tried to do it as well as you could possibly do. There was a social dynamic where, you know, it was good to come home and have stories to tell, and it was good to come home wearing certain insignia and not other insignia. You didn't want to come home, at least at the kibbutz where I was living, from a desk job. You know, that was not acceptable. But it wasn't ideological. It was social, and it was quite natural.
Mm-hmm. And you write a lot about, I mean, I say it's a memoir because it is, but here's this hill, and the hill becomes like the theater. You say at the beginning that the hill spoke to you when you got there. It speaks to you still. And you describe it also as you're the sort of historian of this hill that's totally insignificant and then acquires significance by this Israeli presence on this hill, draws all these Hezbollah attacks and these combat incidents, and then after the Israelis leave, becomes, again, nothing. So it really is almost like a stage set. It's sort of like some sort of the way Shakespeare talks about a stage in The Tempest or something. You know, everybody comes, and then the revels are ended. They're not very much revels. But to get that history of that place, you go back, and you get very involved in the story, particularly of one soldier, Avi Ofner, who was there before you. How did you come to him and sort of... It feels a little bit like he's a bit of an alter ego. He's somebody who gets there. He is a writer, becoming a writer. He's reading a great deal at this base. He's starting to write mostly in letters to several girls from his age group back home and describing things in a way that seems, you say you weren't doing that yourself at the time, but it seems to be something that, like, you picked up his thread.
I knew that I had seen something interesting on this hill, but I also knew that I'm not important. You know, I didn't do anything particularly important. I'm not important except as someone who happened to see it and be able to write about it. So it is a memoir in that I saw these events, and it's told in first person, at least parts of it. But I didn't want it to be about me. You know, Orwell's book, Homage to Catalonia, was kind of a model for me in that regard, mm-hmm. because that's a book that's written in the first person by George Orwell, but it's not about George Orwell. It's about Spain. And I thought that was great, and I wanted to do something similar. So the way to do that was to be in the book, because I'm the glue basically tying the story together, but also to bring in other stories of other guys, some of whom I knew who had been at this hill, some of whom I never met. I found people through a chat room on the internet, and Israel being the kind of place that it is, one cell phone number led to another and led to another and led to another, and soon I had this kind of network of guys who had nothing in common, and most of whom had never met each other, but who had all passed through the pumpkin at some point.
You're listening to author and journalist Matty Friedman, whose latest book is Pumpkin Flowers. He's joined in conversation by fellow author and journalist Philip Gurevich on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
The big find for me was Avi Ofner, who had been at the Pumpkin from 1994, which is really when the hill became notorious because of a specific incident that happened on the hill, a specific Hezbollah attack that was filmed and shown on television. By them. It was one of the early media attacks. They came up the hill with an armed force and a camcorder. This was in 1994.
When he says media attacks, he means one of the first actions by these Islamic attackers, where they film their own action as sort of the objective of the action is to get the film. Right? In other words, you're not trying to gain territory. I mean, of course, if they'd taken the territory, that would make for a better film. But they weren't expecting to take territory. That wasn't the objective. The objective was to produce a film in which they are shown heroically fighting against this overwhelming seeming enemy and prevailing, at least insofar as they come home with a film of it.
That's right. So that happened at the Pumpkin, and that's actually what made the Pumpkin famous, briefly. And Avi was on the hill from 94, which is the year that happened, until 97, which is the year I went in the army. So he was useful as a way of telling the story of those years, and he was also a writer. So he wrote letters from the hill, which were beautiful, I think, and yeah. he was very, you know, he wasn't yet... He was hitting his stride, as right. He was a very young guy. He wasn't ideological at all. He was a cynic, and he was cynical about the army. He told people he was moving to Ireland after the army. He
India,
had a thing about
Alaska,
Ireland.
He had all these fantasies.
And,
right?
And Alaska, he had a whole Alaska scenario. But he had a special. He had a thing about Ireland, and he was just kind of a wonderful character who was much more advanced than I was at the time that I was on the hill. He could see the army from the outside. He could see a situation from the outside. He was critical of everything. I think he was kind of hard to be around because he was kind of a tiring personality, but someone who was, you know, wise beyond his years.
And you didn't know him. You never met him.
I never met him.
So obviously you say he was there till 1997, and the other time the Pumpkin became very famous was in 1997. When there was this terrible calamity that happened to the people of the Pumpkin, but not related to the Pumpkin. You want to
sure.
tell a little
I mean,
bit
some
about the helicopters?
Sure. I mean, some of you might remember one of the few incidents from the security zone that that entered the collective memory and that remains there to some extent is a crash of two helicopters in February 1997. Two big transport helicopters carrying 73 soldiers. One was headed to Beaufort Castle, which was one of the Israeli outposts in our sector of the security zone, and one was headed to the Pumpkin. And when they were still over northern Israel, the helicopters collided with each other and everyone died. And that was really the central, it ended up being the central event of that time because it it sparked a protest movement called the Four Mothers, which ended up over a period of several years getting the army out of Lebanon.
And I mean, the other thing is, as you point you make, that this defining incident is not some triumphant Hezbollah grinding victory over the will of the Israelis. It's
an accident.
I mean, it's a completely. It's not even. I mean, you call it a self-inflicted wound, and it is. But it's almost more abstract than that, right? It's just an accident.
That's right. People still refer to it in Israel as kind of an atomic bomb that went off in the country. The country's so small, and the military is webbed so so intimately into the society, unlike in America. In America, you could lose two helicopters, you know, as we were discussing earlier, and probably for most people it wouldn't impact their own lives, because the military is such a separate group in American society. It's not the way it is in Israel. So when 73 guys died in a minute in February 1997, the entire country was devastated, and people still talk about it like an atomic bomb, kind of this vast catastrophe released by something completely minuscule and ridiculous, which was a series of mistakes made by aircrew, basically, in northern Israel one night in February. And that ended up being...
They were just both shuttling. They were like buses, basically. I mean, they were just like shuttling buses. People from...
They were like buses. The roads in Lebanon, I mean, it's connected to the kind of worsening of the situation in South Lebanon, which is familiar also from the American experience. The roads were becoming more and more dangerous because of what would now be called IEDs. We didn't call them IEDs. No one used that term at the time. This was the 90s. We called them mit'anim, which in Hebrew means payload. So Hezbollah, really masters of the art of the IED, they were making the roads more and more dangerous, and the convoys were getting hit by these things. So the army decided to fly the Lebanon garrisons in on these big helicopters. And that decision led to this accident, which ended up bringing about the collapse, basically, of the military strategy in Lebanon and the end of the whole Lebanon enterprise a few years later.
So you're there in that, first of all, you're going in on the heels of that.
Right. I went into the army a few months later, and my platoon commander was the only member of his platoon who had survived, because he'd been in officer's training. So the rest of his platoon was on the helicopter. He was training to be an officer, and everyone was gone but him.
When you said that you saw something from the hill, I mean, you saw a lot of things from the hill. You saw these things through night vision goggles. You saw landscapes that you also speak very movingly of. But you also saw a kind of historical pivot going on that you describe as, I mean, the book is a coming-of-age story, both of yours and of the other guys, but it's also like coming of age into an age that's like unexpected. And you describe how in the 90s, with all of the hope about peace, you sort of thought of yourselves as, well, we're like, this is the end of something. And of course that didn't work out. And it also was this feeling that this is the new Middle East, and it is a new Middle East, but you're saying it was a completely different new Middle East than what people meant by the phrase the new Middle East at that time. Maybe you can just try to summarize a little bit how that pivot worked and sort of when that became something one was more conscious of.
Right. Certainly not at the time. And that took years to figure out. I made an initial attempt to write about this immediately after the experiences, and I had no perspective on the events, and no one could have understood what the 90s meant. In retrospect, I think in the 90s, the pendulum was swinging in the Middle East, and it was swinging somewhere that no one expected. If you read newspaper clippings from that time, and that's what I spent a lot of time doing, looking for little fragments of information about the security zone, all the newspapers were devoted almost entirely to the peace process. If you remember from the 90s, that's what people thought was going on. Leaders were meeting, they're making agreements. A new Middle East would be created, in which we would go to Damascus to shop, and we'd taste the nightlife in Beirut, and people from Baghdad would come to the beach in Tel Aviv and things like that. There were actually maps published in Israeli papers showing the new highways that were going to be built across the Middle East. So everyone thought that was the new Middle East. In retrospect, that was kind of a fantasy or a flash in the pan. And under the surface of all of this, a new Middle East was being created in South Lebanon. And what we saw as 19-year-olds, too young and stupid to understand what we were seeing, we saw the rise of the new Middle East when those guys came up the hill with their video camera, when they pioneered the IED, when they pioneered the suicide bomber, that's also a South Lebanon innovation. What they were doing was creating what we now understand is the new Middle East. So the pendulum was swinging somewhere completely different. And it was happening in a few different places simultaneously, as these things tend to do. So 1994 was that attack on the pumpkin with the camcorder. 1993, the World Trade Center was bombed, an attack that people thought at the time was kind of a curiosity. Right. Hamas was stirring, Al-Qaeda was stirring, Hezbollah was rising, and this idea was spreading across the Middle East under the kind of stagnant surface of this region with its dictators, and something very important was happening when everyone was looking somewhere else.
I mean, you go so far as to say very clearly that without understanding this, in a sense, that this is the key or the unseen stepping stone, at least, to the wars the post 9/11 wars of the United States, that to understand what our experience in Afghanistan, our experience in Iraq, which has not been a positive experience for Iraq, Afghanistan, or the United States, or the broader Middle East. So I'm curious about something you said earlier, where you said, we're not in that place of Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan and the heroic Zionist sort of survivalist struggle that people got very mobilized by, but we may be in a better place. And I'm wondering how this new Middle East, the unseen result of this pretty bleak period, where you have, and you also describe essentially the Israelis as defeated in Lebanon, retreating, and the other guys being militarily inferior but more determined.
That sounds familiar to Americans, right?
And so forth. I mean, more determined at least as far as Lebanon goes, right. If not Israel being more determined about Israel, and sort of indefatigable, so that, you know, a kind of permanent guerrilla war that. Now, obviously, it's exploded to a whole new stage even since you wrote the book in the last 2 years or so, with Syria completely falling apart, with ISIS and the exes. How is that a better place? And particularly, how can that be a better place for Israel in that hostile sea?
Right. So the region, I mean, has become very dark, and the bottom has completely fallen out. And, you know, my apartment in Jerusalem is about a three-hour drive from Syria. I could leave my apartment in Jerusalem, and if the borders were open, I could be in Baghdad for an early dinner. You know, it's all going on around us. So the region has become catastrophic to an extent that no one could have imagined. Certainly not in the 90s, but even 5 years ago, and maybe even 2 years ago, which is when I submitted this manuscript. So I have nothing positive to say about the region, unfortunately. However, because Israel has always been mobilized for conflict. Mobilized maybe for a different conflict, but mobilized for conflict. And because Israelis have learned to keep the region at bay and to kind of live between bombardments, as we did at the Pumpkin, the strange fuel that drives Israel, if anything, has almost picked up steam in the past 10 years, right? If you've been to Israel, or if you've just been following, you know, the Israeli economy or Israeli culture, the country almost seems like it's in overdrive. You know, the economy's booming, and real estate prices, unfortunately for some of us, are through the roof. We got hit by about 4,000 rockets and mortars in the summer of 2014, and real estate prices in Israel went up over the summer. You know, the movies and just the cultural life of the country, which you don't have to take my word for it. You can just come to Tel Aviv and hang out there for a week, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Tel Aviv, in the same period of time, has become what is said to be one of the best cities in the world, kind of captured this Middle Eastern spirit that used to exist in places like Alexandria and Beirut and this kind of cosmopolitan Middle Eastern centers. And you can find it in Tel Aviv, and Israel is the only country in the region where you can be, you know, safely, well, certainly Jewish, but gay or Christian or Baha'i or Zoroastrian or Druze. And it's an incredibly successful and compelling country. Now, what the connection between that and the collapse of the rest of the Middle East is, I can't really say, except to note that it's happened at the same time. I think the kind of the underlying metaphor of the book, which is this fortress on a hill, ends up helping me understand the country. So I still, I mean, it's because of my own experience, but I see the pumpkin everywhere. I look around and I see the pumpkin. And Israel feels kind of pumpkin-like. It doesn't feel like, you know, the hopeful decade of the 90s is over, but it feels kind of like a hilltop where
you're... that's part of the thesis of... Mahdi wrote these two pieces about the press coverage of the of Israel and kind of going against the grain, obviously, in a big way, saying Israel is actually overcovered. That it wasn't simply about bias this way, that way, though it was also about that. But it was specifically about like the exaggeration of Israel's significance in global affairs altogether, and how excessive attention actually isn't particularly beneficial to accurate coverage. And he was looking particularly at his former organization, the Associated Press, but not singling it out by any means. And it was in the aftermath of the Gaza War of 2014, and he was focusing in part on this idea of sort of, you know, really the story here is this tiny outpost. I mean, that's the way you describe Israel there. I hadn't made the connection as explicitly till you did just now. But there's this huge story of the Middle East, and then there's this insane flooding of journalists into this tiny little outpost which is kind of the opposite of the way it was with the pumpkin, where you were completely
ignored.
Ignored, and in fact, your book is about the fact that nobody, not only were you ignored at the time, but nobody's ever really reckoned with that whole historical period that you now see as this hinge of history.
Right. Well, it's interesting to make a comparison with the work you've done, your book on Rwanda, We Wish to Inform You, et cetera, et cetera. The longest title in the history of publishing.
Not really, probably.
Not really.
But,
We Wish to Inform You that tomorrow we will be killed with our families.
That's right.
Stories from Rwanda. One of the great books. As a kind of contrast between maybe the most covered story on earth per capita, which I think you can make an argument that Israel is that over the last quarter century or so, with a continent that's completely ignored. I mean, when you're in Kigali or Rwanda, how much Western interest is there? How many reporters do you meet?
Very little. I mean, when I first went there was like none. There's an Africa press corps, an international press corps in Africa. And of course, what's most interesting is that in the last decade and a half since I first, or 20 years since I started going there, it's 21 years now, you now have a reasonably sort of modernized African press corps. Mm. So there are some good African newspapers out of Nairobi and some radio and television, and out of South Africa you have a press that actually functions. But for the most part, at that time, there was almost nobody there. And one of the reasons that at the very beginning of the Rwandan genocide in April of 1994, there was almost no international attention to it or coherent press coverage of it, was that the entire African press corps was in South Africa for the post-apartheid elections that brought in Nelson Mandela. So, and of course, one of the knocks on the African coverage of Africa in the international press is that we only pay attention to, bloody, gory, terrible stories of calamity, even when there's a good story. In fact, this was a press corps, many of whom believed quite deeply in the anti-apartheid cause, most of whom, I would say probably all of whom, and who were very excited to be there for this kind of best of times story when the worst of times hits in a country that very few of them knew much about, because it really wasn't that geostrategically or otherwise important. It was tiny. It's the size of West Virginia and had a population smaller than New York City. It's landlocked and isolated and without any natural resources. So it really was a country that only drew attention if it had a problem in the press. And so there were very few people who even knew what was going on, to put it into a context. Not a problem you're going to have in Israel, obviously, though you can argue about endlessly about who knows what's going on, but there, this question of proportionality of the world's attention and what that does to things and what it means, even that in the United States, look, in Israel you can function without knowing Hebrew, though it's a handicap. It's arguably, if you know a few European languages and English, you're in pretty good shape. And in the Middle East, we had almost no foreign correspondents coming into 9/11, certainly, who spoke Arabic. Very, very few. We had even fewer in our State Department and our government offices and so forth. So we were completely cut off in that region with, again, you'd have the sort of bureaus you have in Africa. You know, you'd have a maybe, I don't know where it would be based, probably a Cairo bureau, right, that covered four or five Middle Eastern countries at the time. And then you'd have a Jerusalem bureau that had probably five times as many people covering.
Well, when I was hired,
mostly the West Bank and the occupation period, which is, I guess,
Israel is about, if you, as a percentage of the Arab world, landmass wise, is 0.2%. So 1/5 of 1% of the landmass of the Arab world. And it's 0.01% of planet Earth, 1/100 of 1%. When I started to work at the AP in 2006, we had more than 40 full time news staffers covering the Israel story.
At the AP?
Just for the AP, and I'm not counting fixers and drivers, I'm counting just news staff, like me, print reporters and still photographers and TV crews. And at the time in Syria, we had one part-time local stringer who'd been approved by the Assad regime. That was the AP contingent in Syria. We had more people covering Israel than we had covering all of the countries where the Arab Spring eventually erupted combined, or than in all the countries of sub-Saharan Africa combined. So, you know, one of the reasons that the West was so caught off guard by the implosion of the Middle East over the past couple of years is because for decades no one covered it. And when people said the Mideast conflict, what they meant was Israel. That was the Mideast conflict.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features author and journalist Matty Friedman, whose latest book is Pumpkin Flowers. He's joined in conversation by fellow author and journalist Philip Gurevich. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I mean, as you've pointed out at times, it's not just Israel, it's the Israel-Arab conflict, Israel-Palestinian conflict. But Israel itself is not, I mean, one of the things that you're doing is you're writing about Israel as an Israeli, writing about Israel unto it, you know, unto its own experiences.
Right.
When you talk about how all the soldiers there believed in what they were doing, that it was right, it was probably the right thing to do, whether it was just defending their homes or so, but it was the right thing to do.
Right.
But they obviously come to question whether it was worth it. You point out that in the course of this uncovered, unnamed 15-year period in Lebanon, the overall Israeli death toll was about equivalent to the Six-Day War death toll. So significant. And yet it was a few here, a few there. It was right. Little incidents. It wasn't sort of an ongoing combat operation in the same way.
Like Iraq, you know.
And then you talk about this fortress mentality. How can Israel maintain that fortress mentality with the occupation, with the relationship it's got with the West Bank, with its sort of siege mentality, without just hardening? I mean, you talk about a post-ideological, somewhat cynical, indifferent, turned inward generation. You say it's very, very high energy for what it's doing culturally and economically. But isn't there a huge cost there? To the world and to Israel?
Sure. I mean, yeah, the answer is yes. I've been, as part of a new project that I'm working on, I've been looking at a lot of material from 1948, press clippings and writing from 1948, and it's heartbreaking because they think that the war in 1948 is going to end and there's going to be peace. And that's what people thought. In 1967, people thought there was going to be this war and then there would be peace. 1973, people kept expecting peace to happen. There would be one more war. We'd pay this price, and then there will be peace. And over the past decade and a half, since the collapse of the peace process, since the Lebanon withdrawal, kind of cosmically, it happens in the year 2000, which is strange. But the pendulum really swings in the year 2000. I'll let the mystics figure that one out. But there's kind of a deep psychological change, which is that it's never going to end. It's never going to end. And we might not have a Yom Kippur war where we lose, 2,500 guys in 3 weeks. But it's not going to end. There's not going to be peace, and the region is going to be a disaster for decades. What does that mean for us? It means that we're going to have to keep on losing guys in these inconclusive border wars, like we had in Gaza 2 years ago. There are going to be more rounds like that. And basically what we can hope for is to keep the region at bay to the extent possible, as we live inside our outpost, inside the pumpkin, basically, and we kind of make do with what we have, and live as well as we can. That's the Israeli of 2016. No big ideas. There's not a lot of there's an ideological hardcore on the right, of course, and you hear a lot about them, but most of the country is kind of resigned at the moment. So the question is, how do we maintain ourselves in this psychic state where, we don't have any very big ideas, most of us. We don't have any real hopes of kind of a utopian turnaround in our situation, which people had until recently, which was the situation when I moved to Israel. That's what I thought was going on in 1995. How do we do this without losing our soul? Without becoming so hard that the country becomes unrecognizable. That's a real problem, especially since the conflict hits so close to so many of us. So America can keep the conflict on the margins of its society because the conflicts are far and because the military is peripheral in the society. We don't have that luxury. Most people are in the army.
But, I mean, how do you protect your soul when you're saying generation after generation has to sort of, you talk about the army as the end of childhood, you go from the home of your parents and the bed of your childhood to the army and your commanders, and that this is really the and then you talk about yourself as making aliyah, becoming Israelified by this. So this is sort of what makes people men or grown-ups and makes, people Israelis, and that service is essentially grinding, negative exertion of force against miserable neighbors, often feeling very oppressed, often feeling in the occupation, obviously, just a service that there's no really great way to.
You don't capture the Temple Mount at the end of the.
You don't feel good about it at all, even from a nationalist or a survivalist point of view. It's just crude and hardening. How does that work over time? And I guess one thing that strikes me is you talk about Israel as an outpost, and the way the world sees it is as an outpost of the West to a large degree. Some of the world's attention is on the idea that this is a sort of Western project in the Middle East, that it is European Jews with European money and American money for defense to a significant degree. And you've written a lot about the fact that that's just actually inaccurate,
right?
That like half of Israel's population is Mizrahi, is Jews from the non-European, specifically Arab world. Your first book's about the Jews of Syria. Your second book is about being across the border from Israel in Lebanon. And I should mention, there's a significant chapter where you go, and I think you kind of make it sound like it's easier than it probably was, both practically and internally, to keep your cool through this whole thing. And he goes using his Canadian passport to do what he can't do as an Israeli into Lebanon. After his service, how many years later was that?
2 years later.
2 years later, comes around the long way back through Toronto, and as a tourist with his Lonely Planet guide, goes back to the pumpkin, winding his way down through his Hezbollah country, meeting lots of Lebanese he likes a lot but who aren't too keen on Israel. I like that you find a good way whenever they say, you know, Jews, they're kind of hard to take, and you're like, yeah. You know, you find your way of not having to endorse anti-Semitism while giving, I guess it's not an Israeli who wouldn't agree. But, you know, but then you really are writing about Israel from a periphery or a perimeter that's very different from the conventional history of it, and that makes a kind of counter argument about that. Maybe you can just...
Sure. I mean, I think that Israel has been reduced to a kind of caricature in the West, and for some people it's a good caricature, and for some people it's a bad caricature, but it's a very simple story because people can only take simple stories, and only a simple story will fit in a 600-word news story or in a 90-second TV spot. So, you know, for many people on the left side of the spectrum, which is, you know, where I would place myself, Israel is a symbol of strength or worse, you know, oppression, a mechanized European society that oppresses non-Western, non-industrialized people. The country is so much more complicated than that, of course. As you said, half of the Jews in Israel had nothing to do with Herzl or socialism or the Holocaust or the kibbutz. They come from the Middle East. And those people aren't a footnote in the story. They're, you know, if it's 50%, which it is, they're as much the story as Herzl and Ben-Gurion. And I think that in the 21st century, if you're looking to understand Israel, you have to think a lot less about the Warsaw Ghetto and a lot more about Kurdistan, because Israel and the Kurds have a lot in common. They're minorities that have to kind of survive in the Middle East. And I think that is the way to think about it. And I think that's the way people will think about it. And I'm trying to write about that now. And that's what the next project that I'm working on is going to focus on.
I think it's time for questions. yeah. Oh, yeah. So...
I was curious what news sources you regularly read, especially things that we may not have heard of.
I read Philip Gurevich.
Get you far.
I try not to read daily coverage that much, and that's been my conclusion over, you know, with this bombardment of news, and you can really lose yourself in the daily events, not just in Israel, anywhere, you know, the daily political cycle and the politics, and Netanyahu said this and Abbas said that and Rocket here, and then if you wake up, you know, you kind of wake up 3 months later and you've learned nothing, and nothing's changed, so it's kind of a waste of time. I now try to read books, which give you kind of handle on the broader sweep of events. When I do need to read daily news, I read mostly Israeli media. If you're looking for a decent English language website that does a good job of wrapping the daily stuff, the Times of Israel does a pretty good job of that. And you have some excellent international reporters who do a good job, like Dia Hadid, and there are others. But it's hit and miss. You have to be very careful what you read, and you have to be very aware of where most international reporters are coming from when they report the story. You need to be very skeptical, I think. You know, you need to ask, do the people speaking with this very confident tone about what's going on actually know what's going on? And the answer in many cases is no. So I've become a suspicious consumer of all media and a believer in books more than in daily news.
Do you recommend any books that you've read recently that...
There is a book that was published a year or two ago called Like Dreamers by Yossi Klein Halevi, who traces the lives of seven paratroopers from 1967 as a way of explaining the fault lines in Israeli society since then. There was a book that did quite well in the States called My Promised Land by Ari Shavit. There are older books. A great book, which you wouldn't think would be great in terms of understanding Israel now, but it is a book about the British Mandate called One Palestine Complete by Tom Segev. Tom Segev's written a number of excellent, excellent books. There's a book on the birth of the settlement movement called The Accidental Empire, written by Gershom Gorenberg, which is excellent. It's an excellent kind of glimpse at the way the settlement project was conceived essentially by the left, which is not what people think. Those are off the top of my head.
Has your book been published in Israel yet?
This one is supposed to come out in the fall in Hebrew. It's not out yet.
As I was reading the first half of your book this week, I couldn't help but think of the parallel that Hezbollah itself finds itself in now, in embroiled in a war in Syria. One of their top commanders was just killed this week. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on, you know, your former adversary in southern Lebanon and what they might be going through and how that in the long run may affect Hezbollah and Lebanese society.
That's a very interesting point. I think that, you know, the Hezbollah idea is not to build a better society in Lebanon. Right? It's not war as a tool for the betterment of, you know, the place you're from. It's not a continuation of politics by other means, which is the way we understand it. If you read their literature, and the deputy secretary general of Hezbollah published an important book in English, which is called Hezbollah, the Story from Within, and which is really worth reading, and he kind of lays it out. And the idea is not even to win. The idea in South Lebanon fighting us was not to liberate South Lebanon, and not only to liberate South Lebanon, it was to build in Lebanon a resistance society, a society that's dedicated to war, basically, to religious war as a religious precept, and to death in battle as a kind of ideal for young men. It sounds crazy to Westerners, right? So we often dismiss that kind of rhetoric as rhetoric, or, you know, talking to the base when they actually have rational goals in mind. They fought their way out of their predicament, which is that they're weaker than the West and weaker than Israel, by inverting the story and telling a story in which perpetual war is victory. Death is victory. The suicide bomber that's the idea, that death is a kind of victory. And if you believe that perpetual war is victory, you win. You always win. And it's tragic and ironic to see them reap the fruits of their ideology, because you want perpetual war. Well, it's not always going to happen on your terms. Right, that idea gets loose in the Middle East. It's going to be turned on you, and it has been turned on them, and tragically on millions and millions of other people as part of the kind of cataclysm that we're witnessing in the region. So there's no joy in that observation for me, but they are one of the originators of the idea. And if there are deep thinkers in Hezbollah, or critical thinkers in Hezbollah, and there might well be, I'm sure they're aware of the irony.
With the rise of Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the terrorist bombings in Europe, it seems as if international coverage has really shifted, and no longer is it framed entirely through the prism of Israel. Do you think that shift in both framing and attention is going to affect U.S. and European-Israeli policy?
That's a good question. From what I can tell, for example, from a French proposal that we're hearing about over the past week or two to convene a peace summit. The Americans have certainly remained very invested in the idea of a peace settlement between Israelis and Palestinians. In a way, I think the Israeli-Palestinian thing, or the simple conception of what the Israeli-Palestinian thing is, because it isn't that, but the simple idea of what it is something to cling to in the Middle East for many people in the West, because the whole region is so hard to explain or understand. I mean, try to explain the Kurds and ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra and the Iranians and the Russians and the Israelis and the Americans and ISIS and Assad and Mubarak and Sisi and the Muslim Brotherhood, and you have to understand all these things to understand what's going on. So that's impossible. peace between Israel and Palestine. That sounds pretty good. So I think in some way, people grasp at this as something they can understand and affect in the Middle East. And you can't, because it's connected to the broader mess in the Middle East. But I'm not convinced that the mess in the Middle East, although it has siphoned off some of the reporters, the staffs in Israel are smaller now than they were when I began working for the AP. But it's still disproportionately covered. When Israel goes boom, as it did in the summer of 2014, everyone comes back. So Israel trumps, when Israel is happening, it trumps any other news story. The summer of 2014 saw the appearance of the Islamic State. In earnest, Boko Haram was on a rampage in Nigeria. There was a whole thing in Ukraine that people might remember, an airliner that was shot down by a pro-Russian militia. Israel trumped everything. Hundreds of foreign correspondents covered Gaza, and basically Gaza dominated that summer. It's still the most important story on earth, as I called it in that essay.
You mentioned before that you didn't start writing afterwards because you didn't have perspective. So what was the point that you gained this perspective? And then also, when you went back, did any part of your experience returning clash with your memory of that location?
I did try to write about it immediately, but it just didn't go very well. And then I dropped it. I dropped it, and I assumed that this memory would just recede, which is what happens to most of your weird memories from when you were 19. And instead, something different happened. The memory of this place got stronger and stronger, and I started to see the pumpkin everywhere. So I would see the Americans in Iraq, which started happening 2003, right? And it looked familiar. Convoys, IEDs, videotaped attacks, suicide car bombs, outposts, Afghanistan. It all started to look very, very familiar. And eventually, it took me years, but eventually I realized that what I had seen at the pumpkin hadn't just been important to me, which is what I thought when I initially started writing about it. I just thought it was important to me. I realized that it's important for an understanding of the Middle East, and the Middle East is important for an understanding of the world, because the Middle East refuses to leave us alone. It won't let go. So if we want to understand the world right now, I think the pumpkin is a pretty good place to start, and that's why I went back. It was very strange to stand on that hilltop alone. It was quiet. It was just rubble. I wasn't quite alone, as I read in the book, but all the soldiers were gone, and there was a Hezbollah flag flying from the top of the outpost, but even the flag was faded and torn, and obviously no one had been up there to put a new flag there, and the place felt completely unimportant. It was, you know, it's still the center of my emotional universe and for others, but I think I realized that it was unimportant. So, you know, it had been worth our life, and then it was worth nothing. And in retrospect, that's the basic experience of being a soldier. One day, this hill that you're supposed to defend or capture is worth your life, or this trench, or whatever. And then a week later, it's worthless. And that's kind of that's what it means to wear a uniform.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you to Philip and to Matti, especially.
You so much. Really, really fantastic.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author and journalist Matti Friedman, whose latest book is Pumpkin Flowers. He was joined in conversation by fellow author and journalist Philip Gurevich. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.